Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 1st, 1999. In the fireside room this afternoon is Mary Elise Lowe. Today's session number is 99-9 and is titled Sin and Forgiveness. Let's listen in.
Afternoon, it's a wonderful afternoon to talk about heaven and hell. And my name is Mary Lowe, and I'm a doctoral student at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. And there's a Lutheran seminary out there as well, so I've done some work there. And today, what we're going to do is sing some songs. I'm realizing I don't have the songbook. Sing some songs and talk a little about, look at some scriptural references that kind of inform our ideas of heaven and hell and judgment. And the goal is really threefold. We're going to kind of get a little bit of the roots of these ideas, and then we're going to talk about kind of our beliefs. I mean, do we think these are good ideas or not, personally, like kind of try to figure out where we might stand on these issues. And then finally, kind of look at some of these questions on the board. And if you were just at Jack's session, or even if you went to Wes's Bible study anytime this week, you know, one of the big issues that comes up is how images are used to liberate people or to oppress people. You know, do they lift us up or do they keep us down? The only other kind of introductory thing I'll say before we do a little brainstorming is why hymns? You know, why not just Bible study? You know, why not just, you know, pick up a book by a famous theologian and say, this is what so-and-so says about heaven or hell? Well, part of it is that, especially as for those who are Lutherans in the room, We don't really have the veneration of the saints. We don't have icons. Hymns function so much in our community to communicate ideas about our church, its church identity, and they also mark passages for us: confirmations, baptisms, funerals, weddings. I mean, if you've helped anybody plan any of those, you know how important the music is that's chosen at those events. And also, Gracia Grindel, who's a professor at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, made a comment once in class, and I think she's absolutely right, and I know there's lots of musicians in the room, and that is that every time we sing a hymn, like for some of us that probably sung Amazing Grace, if you figure we sing it four times a year and you're 40, well, it does the math for you. But every time we sing those, we re-experience them. So that time you sang it when you were four, that time you sang it at a funeral, that time you sang it at youth camp or with your grandparents, all those feelings come up and all those memories. And that can be a very powerful force that music brings. So that's why we're looking at this really through hymns, to kind of flesh it out. So what I'm going to do now is let's do a little brainstorming just together. And I've never been to heaven and I've never been to hell, so there are no right answers. There are no wrong answers. So let's just get some... let's get some kind of images up here, and they'll kind of form a backdrop for us as we have this discussion. Okay, so what are some images, words, feelings that you associate with either of these concepts?
Hell's hotter.
Hotter. Okay, fire. What'd you say?
Fire.
Fire. Lead us to Tom, to lead us down the, now starting with hell. Okay. What else? Pardon me?
I didn't see.
Oh,
some eternal.
Both of them?
Yeah.
Okay. What else?
Well, we see it all in popular culture.
Well, heaven, clouds and harps and peaceful.
Clouds, harps, peaceful.
Angels.
Angels.
Devil on the other side.
Devil.
Afterlife.
Afterlife?
Both of these in the afterlife.
Okay.
No tears in heaven.
No tears. Okay.
Heaven above or hell below.
Ooh, good spatial language. Okay. Anything else?
Singing in heaven.
Singing. Ah.
Accordions in hell.
All right, we'll put that over here. There is an accordion in my home, but it's very small. So.
Reward versus punishment.
Okay. Okay. Anything else?
Separation.
Okay. Separation from
God.
There we go. And what would be the opposite of that on the other side?
Seeing your dead relatives.
Okay. So we're with God and that we see old friends.
That's making the assumption you will only see them in heaven.
Yeah, isn't it? Is there anything else that he's dying to get up to?
White robes.
White robes.
Pearly gates.
Ah, white robes, pearly gates.
St. Peter. Who's always at the door no matter what kind of day it is.
And do we have, fire. Okay.
We don't have as many images of hell.
No, but that in itself is something that we're going to talk about in a little bit. Why are we going to talk about this more? One thing that's really interesting, and I'll just point this out, because I worked for years and years in a theological bookstore. And it was probably at the seminary, and it was probably 89, maybe. And this gentleman, he's one of those pastors that really wanted to be a professor of theology at a seminary, wonderful man. And he came in and he said, "I'd like something on angels. What do you have on angels?" And we all looked at each other like we didn't have a clue. And there were two books on angels in 1989. Mm-hmm. Karl Barth wrote a short piece on angels, very famous theologian in this century. And Billy Graham had a book on angels. And that was it. And now, look at it. It's Sophie Burnham, I think that's her name. And we have the Touched by an Angel TV show on CBS every Sunday night.
Whole stores.
Right.
Go to tourist centers, like Christmas stores. Mm-hmm. Next to it is the angel store.
And there's angel stores. And so I think the reason I raise it is not to make you all want to go out and buy angels, but it's just to show that how powerful these models are in our contemporary society. And 10 years ago, nobody was talking about angels except a few evangelicals. And now it's all over the place. So it's just a reminder to all of us how powerful these images are. Let's sing. I thought it would be good to start with heaven. So we're going to start with heaven. And Tom Witt, who's the village musician / bus driver / editor of Holden Literature, is going to be our accompanist. Thank you, Tom. And let's start with Soon and Very Soon, which is in the Blue Book on 744. And let's do verses 1-3 with feeling. This is hysterical. Heaven, what it's like, and heaven, what we'll do there. So now we're going to do heaven, what it's like. So what is the song? I mean, we've got some stuff here. I tore this up, and I'm going to go. We've got, already there'll be clouds and harps, no tears. We're going to sing in heaven. We're going to see old friends. And what we really haven't talked about, what it'll be like. We've got pearly gates and clouds so far. Traditionally, let me give you a little background. In the Old Testament, no, I won't draw it. In the Old Testament, really the world was seen as, if you think of a plate on some pillars with a big bowl on top of it, that was the world, okay? And the world, as we knew it, rested on the plate, and there was the firmament, and then beyond that was the heavens, and underneath that was complete chaos. Okay, so that was kind of the view of heaven, and it was generally thought of to be above. Christianity inherited the belief in the life to come as heaven or hell from certain strands of Judaism and certain apocalyptic worldviews. In the New Testament, we hear about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and you think, well, do they just wear different outfits? You know, who were these Jewish officials? The Pharisees affirmed the resurrection of the dead, and the Sadducees did not. And clearly, throughout his ministry, Jesus affirmed life in the world to come. Traditionally, in the church, heaven is often viewed as four things: ecstasy of worship, vision of God, garden of paradise, and that's very present here at Holden this summer as we talk about the Tree of Life, and the New Jerusalem. So if someone would read, someone should have Revelation 21, and someone should have Revelation 22. And while you find those, Wes in the Bible study today talked about something very interesting to me about the New Jerusalem. And what two things were fascinating. One is that this city of God, this New Jerusalem, is made by God, not by human beings. And that's a distinguishing feature that makes it different than all the Old Testament cities. Secondly, and Wes really fleshed this out nicely, that all the people are God's people and not just the Jewish race. So there's an image of inclusion in this New Jerusalem. So whoever has the Revelation 21...
Are we supposed to find these texts? They aren't marked.
Oh, yeah. I've got that one. So whoever's got the Revelation 22, 1 to 5, I'll start with Revelation 21, 10 to 12. And in the Spirit... This is John's vision. He carried me away to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. It has the glory of God and a radiance like a very rare jewel, like jasper, clear as crystal. It has a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and on the gates are inscribed the names of the 12 tribes of the Israelites. So that's one vision of the New Jerusalem. Does somebody have the Revelation 22 verse? Okay.
Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river is the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Nothing accursed will be found there anymore, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and God's servants will worship God. They will see God's face, and God's name will be on their foreheads. And there will be no more night. They need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever.
Hmm. Now, I'm just curious, as we kind of just get this out there, these images. Do you think this image of the New Jerusalem, or as heaven, is this for each of you, is this an important part of kind of your spiritual journey or your faith? I mean, is this something you think about, getting to heaven, or is it kind of something that you think of as, well, we've kind of outgrown that? It's a view from the ancient world that doesn't really kind of help us today. Or is it something that is really a vision that drives you, that we're going to get there and I'm going to see my family and it's going to be great and I'll be with God? I mean, how does this image function for you in your faith? Anybody? Okay, Rob?
For me, it's really important because I probably do at least 30 funerals a year and work with families that are grieving, and I can't imagine telling them, I'm sorry, but you're never going to see, you know, Aunt Gladys again. You know, I really do believe, and I don't know what form it takes, but I really do tell people that they will see their loved ones again, the New Jerusalem, and I don't know what that is.
So, and I think what Rob's raising is a really important thing that we have to think about with these images is how do they function in people's personal life and in their piety in times of need and in times of great distress? Or just an example that I sometimes use with students is, let's say you have children and you raised your children in the Christian faith, and one of your kids goes overseas, let's say goes to Morocco or goes to Japan to teach English. And they decide that they are going to marry someone who's not a Christian, and the baby will not be baptized in the Christian faith. Or they're not even going to raise him as a Christian. And that's another point where when we encounter other faiths, these issues come up for us, you know, of heaven and hell. Anybody else have a response to my question about if you even think about heaven or if it just kind of seems like it doesn't make sense anymore?
I've kind of given up on it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It depends what you're talking about. Heaven is afterlife, or heaven as New Jerusalem, as Wes is talking about as Bible studies, of a veil that doesn't really have much to do with afterlife. But, mm-hmm. But if we're talking about afterlife, mm-hmm. I think that our faith would be better off without it.
Okay. So now let me think. I was thinking about this today when Wes was talking about his Bible study. Jane mentioned above and below, and many of us were raised with the idea that there's heaven and there's earth and there's hell, okay? And there's these three realms, okay? And if I understand Wes correctly, and please chime in if you're wrong, because I haven't gone to every single one of those Bible studies, and often we think that there's going to be a time, okay, so let's put now, this is now, and then sometime in the future, okay, heaven, this box is heaven, will contain the new earth, okay, and then hell will exist outside of that. And so this is now, this is the future, but what Wes is saying is that rather heaven and hell, as it was described in the apocalyptic time, really exists now, and it has to do with whether or not we live in God's kingdom, in God's empire, or whether or not we live according to the worldly empires of capitalism, of exploitation, and of oppression. Is that a good summary, or would you still?
I don't know what he would say, but yeah, that's yeah. Fairly close.
Yeah, so it has what Wes is saying is that heaven and hell are now, and it has to do with really where we put our faith, whether it's in ourself and powers, that's a central word in his thought, or whether or not, you know, we put God in the center in God's kingdom. So it's kind of a new way of thinking about it.
Right, and you can still believe that, but then you can still have the question of what's going to happen to me after I die.
Right.
Which may be this whole other question.
Mm-hmm.
Related to.
Mm-hmm. And it's very natural for us to want to know what we're going to do after we die. Let's sing another song, and then and while Tom walks over there, one of the things I think I mentioned is kind of what we'll do there traditionally is worship. We'll see God as God truly is. We'll walk in the garden or walk in the New Jerusalem. But what's really interesting, I think, and Robin brought this up nicely, and actually there's a Newsweek piece that's at least 6 years old now, and they asked people if they believed in heaven and hell. And the denomination that most believed were Roman Catholics. I thought that was very interesting. But very few people who said they believed in heaven said heaven had anything to do with God or anything to do with Jesus Christ. It was a place of peace. It was a place of being with old friends. It was whatever is heaven for you now. So there's a song I love that Mahalia Jackson sings, a gospel singer. I'm going to sing and never get tired. And that's her idea of heaven, is being able to sing in God's glory. I mean, forever with never getting tired. But I think it's really interesting because when you start talking to people about heaven, just like Rob did, it doesn't have anything to do with God. It doesn't have anything to do with worshiping at the throne of the Lamb, which is what we get when we talk about the Revelation language. And I think it's really interesting, you know. And what I think is really, I'm trying to sort this out myself, and my guess is that we as Christians, especially in the West, are so individualistic that what we think heaven is what would be heaven for us personally. You know, and it's really interesting. Let's sing, I'm going to sit at the welcome table, and let's do verses 1 and 3. And that's this
basically,
one. Pardon me?
Basically the same tune here.
Yes. Folks who have, if someone has the 1 Corinthians 13 text, and if someone has the 1 John text.
Of the Corinthians.
Okay. And again, both of these texts are about the vision of God, which was especially important in what's called the patristic era, which is really, you know, about the first 600 up until about 700 BC. And then also it becomes very important in the medieval period and for the mystics. You know, if you talk about St. Ignatius or, St. Teresa of Lisieux and all these famous great mystics, that's what they're going for, is to see God face to face. So it's a driving, you know, it's kind of a driving goal. And it's really interesting to think about how few people think about this as part of heaven. Go ahead, Jane.
1 Corinthians 13. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, but then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known.
And does someone have a 1 John? Okay.
1 John 3. See what love the Father and Mother has given us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know God. Beloved, we are God's children now, but what we will be has not yet been revealed. What we do know is this: when it is revealed, we will all be like God, for we will all see God as God is.
Can you read the last section again?
Beloved, we are God's children now. What we will be has not yet been revealed. What we do know is this: when it is revealed, we will be like God, for we will see God as God is.
Wow. That we will be like God. It's not. I would be surprised if we find that line elsewhere in Scripture. Especially in the New Testament. I mean, I did a little digging around, but it's pretty amazing when we think about it. I'm just wondering, before we start on hell, if this sense of this vision of God, of seeing God as God really is, again, if that's anything that really informs anybody's vision of heaven, you know, or is it just kind of something that we've kind of just dropped by the way? Is there any experiences that we've had where we think, wow, that's got to be what it's like to be in God's presence fully, to be all in all? It seems again to me like we've really slipped away from these categories and we have a very individualistic view of heaven, and for most of us it's seeing all relatives. So,
we were just thinking about this song that you just sang, and I don't know the history of the song, but it's media spiritual from slave times. They probably were singing on multi levels here about mm-hmm. going north.
Absolutely.
And escaping oppression, which in some senses you could think of as seeing the reign of God. I mean, mm-hmm. to escape hell.
Right. Right.
But, I mean, it seems like they had more of this idea that Wes is talking about this veil, that we're talking about things on a number of different levels that would include life here.
Right. There's the, you probably know the spiritual Tom, I've got shoes, you've got shoes, all got shoes. There's a line in that, everybody talking about heaven ain't going there. And what's really going on in that, I had an interesting talk with a friend of mine who teaches spirituals, and she was really saying that, you know, what's going on there is that the masters who practice Christianity, the slaves were very aware that they weren't getting to heaven, but the slaves were. And that raises a really interesting point about the models of heaven and hell. And if you were at Jack's session at 3:45, what, you know, we asked, where's my good pen, excuse me. One of the questions here is, how do these, how have they been used to liberate and to oppress? Well, if you're here, and for lack of drop, you're in a terrible situation, okay? And you know that the end of your life is gonna come, and that you've been unjustly oppressed.
What is that little face?
It's a sad face.
Oh.
I will not be teaching in the craft room, okay? And you know the answer to this. I'm just drawing it to kind of flush it out a little bit. If you've been unjustly oppressed here, how might the image of heaven function for you? How might it inform you in this just god-awful existence that you have? How might you think about it?
I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my
home. I am but a stranger here, heaven is my home. Okay? And this is one of the things, if you really get excited about this session and you want to read more about heaven and hell, specifically, there's an African-American black theologian named Jane Cohn who goes after, in several of his books, the way that in the slave faith, that heaven was used to keep people down. Mm-hmm. And Jack talked about it before in Latin America. He called it colonial theology. And colonial theology said to people, don't worry about how bad things are here because it's all going to be better. You know, like, for every tear you cry here, you get an extra harp in heaven. I mean, it's that kind of stuff. So these models are really powerful. And also, as the song that I mentioned about I Got Shoes, everybody talking about heaven ain't going there, the slaves are also very aware that the masters who oppressed them were going to go here. So it functions, both heaven and hell function, because this means justice is satisfied, and this means, you know, living through oppression, unjust oppression is rewarded. And I think what Jack said at the very beginning of a session is absolutely right. This colonial theology, most of us still carry it with us. And if we, you know, we need to acknowledge the way those function for us. Let's talk about hell. Let's sing about hell. I will say one thing about this. While I was looking for hell hymns to sing, no hiding place, and that is, there's actually an old one in the library here. If you look in the, I kind of tried to stick with Lutheran hymnals, and if you look at the older hymnals, there's lots of songs about hell. And there's flames, and there's torture. There's a whole section. You know how when you go through the...
There's not a hell section.
Well, but listen, when you go through the Green Book, you know, there's Advent, there's Christmas, there's society, there's discipleship. There was a section consistently called Conflict with Sin, and there's a section called Temptation and Forgiveness. There, one of them even had a section called Mission to the Jews. So how are, and that's all in this century, you know, and in the span of Christian history, that's not very long at all. And we think we've gotten away from these models, and we really haven't. So let's sing No Hiding Place, and then we'll, and I, one of the reasons I picked this is because somebody's burning. And that was a little hard to find. Let's sing all three verses.
Are you singing this whole solo line here?
No, let's just do it together.
Okay, I don't know how fast this goes.
Do 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 do. And it's kind of a happy hill song too. So that was part of the reason I picked it.
I went to the rocks to hide my face. The rock cried out, hide my face.
were you saying about the hymn?
No, if we could bring it back to the community for worship, you know.
There you go. Well, but that's really interesting. What do you guys think would happen if you said, Pastor, we sang this great song in Holden Village, and I want to sing it in church on Sunday? I mean, I'm asking this as a serious question. And you and your pastor just was in a hurry and said, okay, whatever, I trust your judgment. And you sang it. What do you think would happen in your own congregations if you sang this song? Or another song that said, you're going to hell and you're burning. The sinner man goes to hell and burns. Anybody want to theorize on that?
Get a lot of plaque at worship.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think people would say? What do you think would be their response? Why would you get flack?
It's not theologically correct. Didn't okay. fit into the service.
Okay. Anybody else?
A word of hope, not a word of condemnation.
Okay. So there's no hope in here. Okay. Somebody's going to heaven.
Depends what denomination you are, too. I mean, you could see us in the Baptist church.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, our Lutheran identity is shown through. Anybody else want to just guess what might happen? I can just see the pastor's phone ringing off the hook all afternoon.
Well, it is Southern-regulated and Southern Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, at a recent funeral for Southern Baptist, the man was praised and praised and praised. Like 13, 14 people got up and talked about how wonderful he was. The pastor was visiting pastor, got up. Now, this is in a Roman Catholic church, but he got up and he said, now, come on, we know that Paul had some stuff. Let's talk about that stuff that Paul had. He meant this, the bad stuff that Paul was.
The bad stuff that Paul was.
Because they want to talk about the bad stuff.
Well, I want to get through just 2 points kind of quick so we can have a discussion about where we all think we're going after we die. One of the things that is kind of interesting when you talk about hell is in the New Testament, you know, it was understood as Hades or Sheol, just the underworld. And several different, I hate to call them religions because they weren't religions that we have now, but belief systems in the ancient Near East had an idea that everybody went. Good and bad both went to the underworld. You know, if you remember your Greek myths, people are coming back and forth out of the underworld all the time, okay? There was often this concept of life after, but it didn't necessarily separate people into good and bad. The Greek word Gehenna from the Greek is the eternal abode of the wicked. And there we start to see the emergence of an idea of heaven and hell. And I think Anna said it that we had up here at the chart. And the main idea is separation from God. That is the main idea. And actually, it was interesting, during the medieval period, the scholastics had a twofold, scholastic theologians had a twofold idea of hell. One was separation from God, and the other was something was really punishing you. And that's where we get the ideas of the flame, or the devils with, you know, the pitchfork. Or, you know, you think to yourself, what would be the worst job that you had to do in hell? And like, when I was here in the kitchen, I had to hand scrub the compost bins one day because the health inspector was coming the next day. And that would be like a job in hell, you know. But it's really interesting how the idea has developed. Does somebody have the Revelation 20 text? Okay. And somebody else should have Matthew 13, too.
Revelations 29 and 10. They marched up over the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever.
Okay, so what we get in this is, to change this drawing a little bit, the last two words you read were forever and ever, right? So this separation never stops. Okay, now does somebody have the Matthew 13? Go ahead, Anna.
Just as the weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all evildoers. And they will throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Let anyone with ears listen.
Okay, weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that's probably a pretty common image for a lot of us. I mean, out of scripture, mm-hmm. you know. We've heard that one a lot, I think partially because clergy are much, if they have to talk about hell. The Matthew text in the mouth of Jesus is easier than to deal with than the apocalyptic stuff in Revelation, you know. And also Revelation gets very confusing, as anyone who's been going to Wes's Bible study knows. But again, we see Revelation 21, fiery lake of sulfur, Matthew 25, 41, a place prepared for the devil and his angels. Jude 13, a place of blackest darkness. Matthew 3, 12, a place of unquenchable fire. But the main thing that's interesting here is there's a clear separation, and they both go on forever. Okay. So we talked about heaven, we talked about hell, and now I want to put up a word probably some of you have heard before, really, and we'll talk about this tonight, universalism. Does anybody want to make a stab at what that means?
Everybody's in.
Okay. So, everyone gets in. Okay. So in a universalistic worldview, hell just doesn't exist. Okay? Everybody goes to heaven. Nobody goes to hell. Okay, now let me ask you this, and this is getting, we're really getting to the heart of it now. And what I'm talking about is this question here. The second question. Let me draw this. And then we'll sing a song here in a minute, but I want to kind of get this up so then we're going. Okay, in a universalistic worldview, let's say you die, and everybody goes. So we're all out there together, doing whatever it is that we do in heaven. Okay, here I am. This is Mary. Mary's in heaven. And what if I was a really awful, awful person? Okay? And I killed people, and I stole things, and I was stubborn, and I was prideful, and I was raised in the church, and people tried to save me all the time, and I just kept saying, I don't want anything to do with God. I don't want anything to do with God. I don't. There's no such thing as God. You can't push God on me. And that was what I had decided. That was what I had chosen. Now, what happens to my choice if I'm instantaneously taken up to heaven? All those choices I made where I kept turning towards myself rather than God. Do you think I wanted to go to heaven? Does anybody see where I'm going? What we're talking about is free will, and this is a huge issue when we talk about the belief in universalism. If in this life I made constant, God gives us free will, we can get up, we can walk around, we can make decisions. If everyone goes to heaven, then there's really no such thing as free will, because I can't choose not to go to heaven. Are you following me? Mm-hmm. This is really interesting, but what happens, why it's so important is because God gives us free will as creatures, does it make sense that God would take it away and just suck us up to heaven and not give us the chance to say no? And this question is so important when we talk about world religions. Okay, there are many people who say, well, we're all just going to go to heaven. Well, you know what? If I'm a Buddhist, or if I'm a Hindu, or if I believe in animism, or many of the different forms of reincarnation, singing at the 12 gates of Jerusalem, at the pearly gates with St. Peter, that's not where I want to go. And there are many faiths that have just an ongoing cycle. There's a book by a gentleman, I'll write it up here, named Heim, who's written a book called Salvations. And many of us are familiar with the image of, there's one mountain, and this is God, okay? And this would be the Christian road, and this would be the way Hindus go, and this would be the way Buddhists go, and this would be the way Muslims go. But, you know, we're all really get to the same place. How many of us have heard that argument before? Okay, almost all of us have heard that argument. And what this gentleman, Heim, is saying in his book Salvations is, you know what? This is really Christocentric. This is what Christians want to make themselves feel better. And what he says is that saying that all the mountains are the same, that's like saying
if you want to fit in the United States, you should all act like white middle-class people. It makes all the religions the same. And it's really a fascinating argument. And the book came out about 4 years ago. And people in the religious, kind of world religions community still aren't quite sure how to sort it out. Because for about 15 years, this we're all going to the same mountain has been what makes people feel really good. It's solved the problem of world religions. And what Chaim is saying is, absolutely not. You're not solving the problem at all. You're just making everybody just like you. And what he's saying is, if we really want to respect Hindus, then we have to talk about reincarnation. If we really want to respect Buddhist beliefs, we have to talk about nirvana and getting out of the cycle of reincarnation, not worshiping at the throne of Jesus Christ. Okay? So it's really interesting. And it's a part of this argument called universalism, which is contrasted with what we've been talking about, exclusivism, heaven or hell. So go ahead, Tom.
It's still putting so much emphasis on the faith as what happens after you die. Mm-hmm. What if you believe you're a Christian and you don't think that has anything to do with mm-hmm. Christianity? What do you call that?
You mean if Christianity doesn't have anything to do with the afterlife? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I sort of had this vague sense that God is stronger than death, and that's mm-hmm. about all the farther I'm going to mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. But if you have a faith that's totally focused on getting some place after you die, you still have a very different faith than mm-hmm. if you don't have that. And that's why I say I think we'd be better off without it.
Without heaven or hell.
Whether it's universalism or exclusivism, mm-hmm. I still think it's just kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. The focus is somewhere else other than what you're doing now.
What do people think about that? I mean, that's a pretty big statement to say we can, and I'm going to just kind of make Tom's position a little more strident to try to get a little discussion going. What if I said we can have Christianity and we don't need heaven and hell?
I mean, there's a lot of theologians out there that would say that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, would people feel comfortable with that?
I agree with Tom. The point is how we live our life now. Mm-hmm. Responsible, just lives. It's so. I don't know what to do with that. Like Tom said, aside from the fact that it's bigger than I can understand, and mm-hmm. some sense of reunion with people in my life, or mm-hmm. some continuing sense of existence. But it's mm-hmm. it's really not part of the way that I mm-hmm. understand it. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else could do without or need heaven or hell?
I'd say for the large majority of my Religion 1 students, that Christianity without heaven and hell is inconceivable. Hmm. It is the goal, it's the reason, and it's their anxiety.
It's getting there.
It's hard to get them to ask questions about religion because they've been taught to ask questions is to doubt and to doubt. It calls into question whether you get to heaven. Hmm. And they're convinced they're going to see grandma and grandpa in heaven, and that's where they want to avoid going to hell, and they want to know what they have to do to get mm-hmm. to the right destination, not the wrong one. Hmm.
Anybody else?
I feel like the only time heaven and hell comes up for me in my life now is when I talk to my kids, well, right now just one kid, about death. Mm-hmm. And it's like, then it becomes an issue. I mean,
right.
What happens after you die and having to explain that to them? I mean, it's fine for me to wrestle with big theological concepts, mm-hmm. but when you're trying to tell a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, mm-hmm. And we never, I don't think we painted the same picture of heaven that I grew up with, but certainly the mm-hmm. idea of being with God mm-hmm. after you die is there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where I have difficulties mm-hmm. when it's passing stuff on.
Right. And the other concept that we haven't talked about at all is purgatory. Mm-hmm. There's two other.
That was my response.
Yeah. There's two other. Let me draw you a possible death scenario chart. And I'll do this really quick because I want to have a little. That's right. Okay. So we have. So let's call this A, and this is universalism. Okay. If you want to know more about this, please attend the Heaven and Hell Forum this evening in this room at 8:30. Okay, so we've got universalism. And then let's call this traditional, and I'm going to put Protestant because that's what I mean here. Okay, we've got a split. Okay, this would be
HB, this would be HE double toothpicks, as you used to say earlier. Okay. Then we've got purgatory, which this will be my first time drawing this, so I'm counting on the Roman Catholics to help me out. Okay, you've got kind of a, the people who go to hell are there to stay, okay? Yeah. However, there is an, I'm not going to call it an intermediate state, because that's not right. It really is purgatory. And Augustine believed in purgatory. I mean, it was all over the early church.
Yeah, I believe in purgatory.
And if I was going to draw it, let's say, I hate to draw a dip, but you do, you kind of dip down a little bit. And then through purgation, at some point, you re-enter the trajectory of heaven. Okay? But the little research I've done on it says that you don't go here, and you never go to hell and come back up. Right. You go to purgatory, and then you come back.
Can you go to hell from purgatory?
Purgatory to hell.
Can you go from hell to purgatory?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we'll draw that too.
Right, and some people are still praying for the souls in purgatory.
Right. Okay.
So they really
does
are.
Everyone go to purgatory?
No. If you don't, no. Some people are chosen immediately.
Yeah, some people go right
now. Then there's another view, which has a really big word. Apostasis. Just ignore that completely.
Hey, but where does limbo fit into this?
Let me finish this, and then we'll fill in limbo.
Yeah, we had four tiers when I was growing up.
Did you?
Heaven, purgatory, limbo, and hell.
Well, okay, let me draw this, right. And then you can tell me where limbo goes. Now, in apocatastasis, there's no purgatory. Now, this is actually found in Gregory of Nyssa, Clement of Alexandria, and Origen, although Augustine hated it. So it's not like it's kind of coming back in vogue.
And didn't Origen get declared a heretic for this?
Well, he got declared a heretic for a lot of things, but this is one of them. But there are certain theologians who are starting to embrace this model as kind of close to this. The big difference is you're moving along, death comes, and we won't get into whether it's death or universal salvation. Okay, some people go to heaven. Okay, some people go to hell. No purgatory, that's what Protestants like this. But then at some point, and I haven't figured this out yet, something happens, and all of hell is brought up into heaven.
So hell just turns into purgatory, essentially.
Well, yeah, but what's interesting here is the driving force in this model is that, okay, let's say, for example, I'm here in heaven. Of course, that would be where I would live.
Right.
And let's say that Dan is down in hell. There's no way this can be heaven for me if I know all things, if I'm worried about Dan. And I would be so worried about Dan in heaven that it couldn't be heaven for me. Okay? Nor for God to be God and for all things to be all in all, ultimately everything has to be taken up into God. So these are kind of four models. And before we just rush them around, tell me where to put limbo.
Well, I just thought limbo was where children who die before they were baptized went. They just hang out in limbo.
Hanging babies. So kind of in here? I mean, are they in heaven?
I mean, this was a huge issue for me after my sister died.
And we were
kids. And we spent hours calculating how much time we were spending in purgatory after we died. I mean, this was our world.
Sure.
So then can you be prayed out of limbo?
No, you're stuck in limbo. You can pray out of purgatory.
What's really unfortunate is it was one of those theological discussions with the hierarchy of the church, and it really, they didn't know what to do with it, so they put it in limbo, literally, and that's what happened to it. It's like, hello, I mean, deal with it, you know, but it was because of what happens to the soul of a person who isn't baptized,
right?
Then, you know.
And but hasn't reached the age of responsibility.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's why the death of children is a biggie.
Yeah. Right, and this is a really excellent way to make this discussion real for us. I mean, you talked about it with Elspeth. You know, my sister and brother lived across the street from a huge Roman Catholic church, and they had two funerals almost every Sunday. And by the time those boys were six, and then their neighbor died of cancer, they knew it all. They were totally up on death, really comfortable with it. Ooh, come and look at Mary. The body's in the casket. And now they're either going to put it in the ground, or they're going to bury it, or they're going to burn it. And it was just, they were totally comfortable with it. You know, and I think the issue of talking to children and dealing with the death of children and dealing with the death of adults really pushes this for us. So anybody have any suggestions or questions about this? We have one more song to sing, and I do want to get to that.
But it's...
So the later model, I mean, is that, where is that?
This one?
Yeah.
What was your question?
Is that an old proposal?
This is a really old idea that a few theologians are starting to embrace again. And I think what it really is this allows the Protestants to do what purgation does for the Catholics.
Yeah.
It gets, the only difference is, and correct me, you Roman Catholics, if I'm wrong, in this, hell goes on forever and ever. In this, all things.
Yeah, hell stops.
The hell stops.
It's actually venial and mortal sins.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. What nobody can answer is what happens here.
So it's universalism with a brief punishment.
Right.
Yeah.
And the strength of this model, the strength of this model, and this model, and this model, is we don't lose our free will.
But then you have to ask yourself,
is free will worth really holding on to?
But there's also the other one. Some of them is, some people insist on holding on to some sense of hell punishment so that there is justice.
Absolutely.
The other thing is that justice comes in. If you lead a totally unjust life and you get vaulted in the heaven,
right.
Where is there ultimate justice?
And so those are the two, when you talk about hell, and is hell, I think I wrote up there, is hell a model that we should hold on to for today? You really could say it has two functions. Dan just named the one about justice, and the one about it does preserve our free will. So then you think, oh, maybe we shouldn't just get rid of the concept of hell.
Is there any biblical basis for the last two? I mean,
well, that's why the Protestants have largely rejected. There's two reasons why the Protestants have largely rejected purgatory. One is because there's not a lot of biblical basis for it. And two, because, especially the Lutherans, during the Reformation, at the very beginning of the Reformation, that's what Luther was all over, was people buying indulgences to get out. But, you know, I haven't seen any Roman Catholics selling indulgences, and I'm hanging out with Dominicans and Jesuits and Franciscans. And so it's not really an issue anymore. And again, the latter one, the apocatastasis, the best quote would be to say that, and I'd have to look it up, where it says in the New Testament that everything will be in God. God will be all in all. That everything that exists will be in God. So hell couldn't exist in that model. Yes, sir?
I'm still confused about a couple things. One is...
not confused.
Yeah. I'm sure everyone else has it clear, so I just want to get it clear. But, you know, free will, if you were saying before, okay, I'm this person and I think there is no God, and on.
Mm-hmm.
But what about someone who does? Like the Ku Klux Klan or the white supremacist groups who read the Bible every day and they use that to kill people and to do mean things. You know, so
I think they're doing God's will by doing that.
Well, they are, yeah, in their mind. And so, or the other thing is this whole free will thing. I mean, what about doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do? And never minding the fact that, will I go to heaven for doing it or not? You know, like Tom's talking about. That seems to me free will. I can say I'm going to do what I believe God wants me to do, whether or not there's a heaven to care about for everybody or for me or, you know, and not some people. I just don't quite get it.
Pop one in there too, because my mother always hits me with this one. How can you have, if you're a finite being, how can you have a free will about eternal or infinite things? The reason my mom doesn't believe in eternal hell is she doesn't think there's anything that you could do in finite time that merits eternal agony and punishment. And so, you know, because we're talking about an ultimate destiny.
Right.
But we're finite, mortal creatures. And so how does free will enter into that just a sense of choice?
And it really depends on, you know, what is more important to you. And this gets down to, I think there's always a point for me where theology gets, where you move from, this is what might happen and this is what could happen to, this is what I've radically experienced in my spiritual life. And this is the commitment I've made. And like, I can only speak for myself. And in that, I think the love of God is much more encompassing than my free will. And if I have to err, if you think of this way, if you think of, I'm standing on the top of Martin's Ridge, and over here is free will as most important, and over here is the love of God, well, I'd rather err on this side, you know? And so I don't really know what I'd say to your mother, except I think she's right. Because ultimately, I think we're all getting it there. But one of the things I need to keep in mind is that there's a lot of people for whom these models, these two models are it, you know? And I'm not out to change anyone's mind. It's kind of my intention to get us thinking about how these still function. And these are awfully important. I mean, it came up again in Jack's talk just now. If your only focus is on the soul,
it's better to kill somebody than to let him be an animist living in the jungle 1600 years ago in Central America. Mm-hmm. Their body is worthless. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a good answer.
But I'd still put like E or some other letters there, because there's some really respected theologians that just say, okay, you've got a faith, and then you've got a death, and you've got a big question mark.
Absolutely.
And they're totally fine with that. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not included. They would just totally downplay any notion of heaven as the afterlife.
Or like process theology,
where
you really move into mm-hmm. God's being, but not in any sort of individual identity sense. Mm-hmm. Just sort of.
Right. And that's another question that we could have talked about today. Process theology is a kind of unique school of thought that Dan's talking about. And what happens in process theology is, probably in all these models, I will still be me. Like Rob said, how important it is to know your relatives in heaven. My understanding of process thought is that when you get there, I basically lose myself in the being of God. So I'm not going to know my relatives because I won't exist anymore.
And neither will they.
Yeah. And neither will they. And for some people, that's a very positive vision. And for other people, they think, God, I really want to see Aunt Judy. Right. So again, there's lots of, we could have done lots of schools of thought. And ultimately, Karl Barth, major Protestant theologian in this century, and Karl Rahner, both ultimately said, they tended towards this model. They said, I really think if I had to put money down, it's universalism, but it's really a mystery. So pretty. But anyway, just keep thinking about this. We're going to talk about it more tonight. Go ahead.
In terms of social location, I know for a lot of African American friends in their communities, it's a very, very pertinent question.
Heaven and hell?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
A white liberal mm-hmm. question.
Yeah, and I think that's, if I understand you correctly, I think what Jane's saying is that for middle class, educated white people, we're very comfortable saying that, we don't really need these models anymore. But if you think about even what Jack was saying earlier about the rise of fundamentalism in evangelical churches in Central and Latin America, primary categories.
And how that's still used.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, well, we're out of time. I'm sure nobody wants to miss second setting. So thank you very much.